Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan. I've been playing some Dungeons and Dragons because I'm really cool like that. Let's get it started. All
pelicans.
All the time.
Welcome to the show. It's been quite a while since Michael and I have had a podcast. Michael, how are things in Utah?
Going good. I mean, it's an exciting time, especially when you see, you know, the Jazz doing exactly the opposite of what the Pelicans are doing. I mean, people here don't have much to be excited about outside of a rebuild. And then, you know, you see from afar all the exciting things going on with the Pelicans. You know, obviously just coming off of Summer League was the last time we talked. We've had Team USA uniform unveilings, a lot of things since then. I mean, it's really been an off season that's been nonstop. I can't think of a team outside of maybe the Heat, that it would have been more fun to be a fan of in the past couple months.
Right. Yeah. So, Team USA game, we didn't get to talk about this at all. And I don't know how many people actually got to watch it since it was like an NBA TV special. But, you know, everybody came out of both the team practices and that game and basically said, there are two locks who are here for the Olympic team, and that's Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving. So you watched it. Anthony Davis had to get 22 points, 7 rebounds. Was there any big man out there who even came close?
I would say the only one that was close was Kenneth Faried. And you saw Faried do similar things in, you know, the rookie sophomore game and that kind of open style exhibition game where not much defense is played, but that guy's going to hustle nonstop no matter what. He was the only one that I would consider close, but when you look at all the things that Anthony Davis could do, I mean, again, the highlight from the one play where he essentially grabs the ball in midair, which, you know, I think he deserves a little bit of applause on that one. You see a lot of guys, and he even did it earlier in the game, where they use that opportunity just to swat the ball into the fifth row, you know, to get the oohs and the ahs from the crowd, and Bill Russell was the king of blocking a ball and tapping it back to himself for a teammate to get transition going. So that, first of all, that he was able to do that and then get out in transition and finish the way he did, you know, that was a highlight play, but there was a lot of small things that got me really excited. I mean, first of all, you could just see so many times in that game with him sprinting down the middle of the floor, how that opened up opportunities for players on the fast break and that's what really got me so excited. I mean, if the Pelicans get out and run, and Anthony Davis is running down the center of that floor, and Ryan Anderson is spotting up with the guards and wings that we have, that's got to be so exciting. And you got to see a little bit of it, of what Anthony Davis could look like in transition in that exhibition game.
Yeah, and he was particularly deadly rolling to the basket in the pick-and-roll game they had going there. So Jrue Holiday, it seemed to me, at everything that I've seen about it, he appeared to be playing off the ball a lot. Do you think that's something we should see, or is that just because of the personnel they had in this USA game?
Yeah, no, I mean, well, I think we have a lot of the same personnel. I mean, you put Tyreek and Gordon on the floor, and you could, you know, you have three guys who at least in pretty big stretches in their career have played the point guard or lead ball handler position, whatever you want to call that. And Holiday looked really good off the ball. He had a nice little curl that he came off the baseline, caught it about 17 feet out, drained a jumper. He also could do that and then take it to the hole and lob it to a big man. So he was really good there defensively, is where I was the most impressed. I mean, it was just so nice to be able to see a point guard who could pressure the ball, you know, 40, 50, 60 feet out from the basket and not just get completely, you know, destroyed by the guard and give up penetration. He was fantastic on the ball. I would say the only thing I noticed that, you know, I'd like to see him improve upon a little, and Monty said after the game, and it's also something he said about Tyreek Evans, is Holiday just catches himself looking at the ball sometimes when he's playing off it. His weak side defense isn't great, but again, these guys 22, 23 years old. Monty's got a lot to teach him, and you know, the next couple of years are going to be really exciting, as much on the defensive end as it will be on the offensive end.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the big things that came out of that game was they had a lot of, you know, highlight clips. And, of course, Anthony was there and Barnes putting one down on poor Ryan Anderson's head. But the big one was, you know, Kyrie Irving scoring all of his points in the game. And I actually was really interested to watch that highlight reel because I wanted to see who he was doing the scoring on, because I was thinking, well, I knew Holiday was on against him, so was Holiday guarding him and Irving was just smoking him? And no, I was very comforted to see that it was Damian Lillard guarding him, and it was embarrassing. There was 9 distinct plays where it was Lillard was supposed to do something to slow him down on a pick and roll, and only on one play did he manage to, I wouldn't even say good enough defense where he actually stayed with Irving. He just kept, like, he would even, like, do, like, he tried to hedge a pick so that Kyrie wouldn't go around it. And then Kyrie would dribble the other direction, and Damian Lillard would kind of hang out, like he was going to stop the big man from rolling or something. I couldn't figure out even what he was trying to do. So I was very pleased that it was not Jrue. And I also got very pleased because I hate Damian Lillard now because he won the Rookie of the Year, and Anthony Davis deserved it.
Yeah, I'm not trying to bash on some of the young point guards. I mean, but to me, with, you know, people came out of that game saying hands down Kyrie Irving was the best player on the court. First of all, he was defended, you know, as you said, by a below average defender, if I'm going to be nice, but he also played no defense of his own, and he led, you know, both teams in turnovers. So there has to be some more to the game than just scoring and, you know, the oohs and ahs created by the crowd. I mean, I guess I'm going to believe in these point guards, the Damian Lillard, the Kyrie Irving, when they, you know, at least show me what guys like Derrick Rose or Russell Westbrook have shown me, that in the playoffs, when good teams are actually concentrating on you, that you could still score efficiently. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, I saw, you know, one of the articles was, you know, who would you take, Anthony Davis or Kyrie Irving today if you got to pick one? And, you know, it seems pretty unanimous that people would take Kyrie Irving. And I absolutely don't get that. And, you know, we had Henry Abbott on here that said he wouldn't trade Lillard for Davis, but his reasoning at least was somewhat sound in saying that, well, you know, the injury issues concern me. I don't agree, but at least that was some reasoning. You can't say the same with Kyrie because he's been even more injury prone the last 3 years. So I don't know. I hate being a homer. I don't want to be a homer. I like being as objective as possible. But to me, you know, Anthony Davis was already the best player in that exhibition game, and I expect him to be the best player, you know, when we look back 10 years from now and look at that roster, you know, say that Anthony Davis had the best career out of everybody that we saw in that game.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had that post when we were talking about all of the free agents and who was coming in and doing that analysis. And, I mean, it is 100% sure in my mind that I think the Pelicans managed to get several good players with Evans and Drew. And if that, you know, prompts Gordon to actually reclaim his game, then in a way we basically acquired three good players in this offseason, which is nice. But I don't actually expect any of them to be superstars. I don't expect any of them to be like, you know, the guy that you would ever want to hang a team on, or, you know, even be like a second banana if the first banana is amazing. But Anthony Davis has literally all the potential in the world. And if you look at his numbers, he outstrips every 19-year-old who's ever played the game. Just he's way better than all of them. So, I mean, I cannot wait to see him this year. And even if he's following the schedule of like Kevin Garnett in his second year, like basically contributed 12 wins to a team, and by his fourth year is contributing 18 or 19 wins to a team, which is, I mean, that's just amazing. So if we can get that out of Anthony Davis in any way, shape, or form, I'm ecstatic. So I can't wait to see him play. I'm so excited. I want games to start now, but we got 2 months before anything goes on.
We do have 2 months, and the exciting part for some people after that was we thought free agency and trades were all done and dead, but the Pelicans went out, and along with five other teams, were pursuing Greg Oden. It appears, you know, according to most outlets, that it basically came down to the Pelicans and the Heat, with the Pelicans offering, you know, a little bit more money, but the Heat offering probably a better chance at a ring, and also a guy that Greg Oden really looks up to, and LeBron James, to take the pressure off of him. You know, the Pelicans came in at least second to Miami. I guess missing out on him, should we be disappointed at all? Would signing of him have meant anything, or, you know, was this just an attempted purchasing of a lottery ticket, and, you know, really nothing to be upset about that we didn't get him?
I think you should be disappointed that we didn't get him because of what he could be. I think, but really the way my world works, I don't think Greg Oden will have any meaningful basketball this year. I mean, I have a feeling that for the Heat, he will be as impactful as Eddie Curry was for them 2 years ago when they brought him in. I mean, the guy has not played basketball since, what was it, 2010 was his last game?
Nine, yeah.
So, 2009. So, I mean, that's a long time to be away from the game of basketball when your game was already really raw, because you got to remember that about Oden was, you know, he was hanging his hat on defense and rebounding in a lot of ways, and, you know, the articles that were coming out about him during his rookie season, or actually his second season, because his rookie season was a complete loss, were, you know, all pointing out the fact that, yeah, he's an amazing rebounder and he's a good defender, but, you know, he's like a turnover machine, and he's got to really figure out how to play offensively in the NBA. Having been out of the NBA for 3 years, 4 years isn't going to help you in that. So I don't. Maybe with the Heat, he might be able to just settle into that rebounding role and do okay. But if he plays more than 20 games, I'll be pretty surprised.
So let me ask you this. A couple of days before, Gustavo Ayon was released by the Bucks. He didn't clear waivers. Atlanta actually picked him up. But Let's say that Gustavo cleared waivers. Who would you have preferred for this upcoming year, Greg Oden or Gustavo Ayon?
Greg Oden.
Really? Just said you didn't think he'd play 20 games.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, Gustavo Ayon, and I love Gustavo Ayon, but he is what he is, and he's not going to be any better than what he is, and what he is not a guy who's going to move the needle for you. Oden at least has a chance to move a needle. Like, maybe I'm wrong.
What chance? I don't. What percent? You say that what?
Think he's got like a 20% chance that he'll come back and play pretty well.
So if we had a multiverse, in one out of every five universes, he would move the needle.
Yeah.
Do
you disagree?
Oh yeah. I mean, this is always the thing. I know the guy. He had potential, and I mean, this is so many years ago. We have to, I mean, to me, it's almost like having a completely different person. You have to get out of your head the person that he was 5-6 years ago and the potential that he had. I mean, you literally have never had anybody in the history of the NBA to come back from, you know, essentially what he's been through. Not only that, but had some depression and alcoholism problems that you don't know, you know, if they're going to resurface or not. Also put on a lot of weight, doesn't really have the conditioning. I don't think of him as former number one pick Greg Oden. I think of him as a 7-footer who hasn't played in nearly 4 years. And to think that he has a chance of moving the needle, I don't buy it. To me, Gustavo Ayon, yeah, I guess he is what he is, but I'll take the guaranteed 6 fouls, you know, the fact that he'll be able to participate in practice and help the other guys, the interior passing, you know, I'll take at least the guaranteed C+ over a possible C, but a likely F because he'll be in street clothes. So I don't know. Between those two, I understand who has the bigger name, but if I honestly had the choice between the two, I would have taken Gustavo and just been happy to have another backup big man, you know, that I could throw in there if and when injuries occur.
Yeah. Well, that now, next question, we still, if you believe we need a center, we still don't have one. I mean, is there anybody sitting out there on the free agent market that you would like to see the Pelicans go after?
See,
and it's got to be a realistic thing, so don't say Pekovic.
No. See, I mean, I wrote a little article about this after Oden signed elsewhere, and to me, the top guy is still the same. I know, you know, people are thinking center because we were going after Oden. I think they were just going after, you know, the potential home run. They probably believe some of the same things you believe, or at the very least, you know, get him, energizes your face, maybe sells some more tickets, whatever. I would go after a guy who, one, fills a need, and two, is simply the best basketball player available. And to me, that's Beno Udra. And I think he's needed because, okay, I'll just ask you this. Jrue Holiday goes down for 2 weeks, and as we'll talk about the schedule, if it's the wrong 2 weeks, we'll have like 15 games in that 2-week stretch. But he goes down for 2 weeks. Who's your starting point guard? And by that I mean, who's the guy that you trust to facilitate all these other options if Holiday goes down? Who are you plugging in as the main facilitator?
Probably Tyreke Evans.
So,
and I don't like it, but he's the guy I would choose probably.
Right, and I mean, so now you're weakening two positions because one, after bringing Evans in and saying all these things you love about his ability to isolate and post up and wreak havoc off the bench, now you're putting him into a role where he's more of a facilitator. You're taking away that aggressiveness. Plus, now you're killing this, you know, weapon off of the bench. So now you're weakening yourself in two positions. Brian Roberts, I know, is a guy that you and I want nothing to do with. Maybe you could shift Eric Gordon down to point guard for small period of time, or Rivers. But again, none of these guys are guys that you trust full time to facilitate an offense and set up other guys. To me, you know, Bino Udra, I would feel comfortable with him in a 2 or 3 week stint, you know, running an offense and allowing guys to stay in the positions where they were. So, you know, he's the best player available in free agency, and I honestly think he fits a need. I'm more than willing to trade or just get rid of Brian Roberts and let Pierre Jackson play in Europe for a year. And, you know, that would be the guy that I would chase.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like Bino. I don't know if I would. I mean, I guess he has not signed anywhere because he wants to find some team that might offer him more than just a minimum contract. And I'm not sure how lucky he's going to be at getting that. I don't know. I don't know if he'd be willing to accept so small of a role, though, because if Holiday doesn't go down, which, you know, you kind of expect him, he'll miss a few games. But if Holiday plays, we've already seen Monty is perfectly happy playing his point guards 38, 40 minutes in a game. And that means we're already pretty short guard minutes. And that means Austin Rivers isn't going to get very much time. I would rather just, you know, roll the dice with Austin as a backup. I mean, this is still a year for growing and figuring out what the team has and what it is. So let Austin Rivers do it and, you know, don't bring in somebody to take those minutes from the guy.
Yeah, I guess I partly agree, but the other part of me says if Austin Rivers can't beat out Bino Udra for minutes, you know, then he doesn't really deserve them. I mean, at some point he's going to have to beat out a guy like that. And if, you know, and if he does and Bino's not happy about it, well, oh, well, tough luck. You know, you sign your contract with us and we're paying you more than other teams were willing to. So if you get paid $2.5 million this year, you know, just to get spot minutes and sit on the bench, then, you know, you're going to have to take it and like it. I don't know really what else to tell you. I guess I'm not going to worry about those things as much as trying to figure out how to make my team as good as possible and provide as much competition. But, you know, in all honesty, if there was really a small forward or a center out there that I liked, then, you know, Bino Udra wouldn't be my target. But almost by default, I mean, you look at what's out there and he's the guy almost by default. If I had to sign a guy that I think could actually make an impact. The only other one I really like is, so I'll ask you, you look at Jason Smith, Ryan Anderson, Anthony Davis, Greg Steensma, Jeff Withey, who's the toughest guy in that group? Who's the guy that you would be terrified to walk past in a dark alley?
From that set?
Yeah.
Wait, am I supposed to actually pick one? Seriously?
Exactly. I mean, so to me, I would love just the nastiest, toughest, Mighty Ducks, one or two, Bash Brothers, whatever type of mentality in there. I've always liked Ivan Johnson.
Really? Mighty Ducks.
Are you kidding? I mean, come on. We're all slaves to what we grew up with. And Mighty Ducks 2 was one of those in the summer, you know, just watched infinite number of times with my cousins. But anyway, yeah, I'm drawn upon them, but the point remains the same. I want some kind of enforcer and nasty guy. Ivan Johnson isn't a prototypical center. He's only like 6'9", 6'10", on a good day, but he's really thick, well-built, and he's just one of the nastiest, meanest, toughest guys, you know, out there. If I want 6 fouls, I want them to hurt. If I want a guy setting picks, I want them to be bone-crushing. You know, he has a better mid-range jumper than you would expect. That would be the guy that I would go to out of all the big men. But even him, I don't know if he would ever get a minute. If everybody's healthy, I don't know if he would surpass Steensma or even Jeff Withey, which he would have to do to get in the rotation.
You know, I mean, I see where you're going with the with having a tough guy and an enforcer, but if he doesn't have, like, a really discernible basketball skill other than hitting someone, I don't know if I really want the guy on my team. He's not that great of a rebounder. He turns the ball over. Something there that you get excited about other than the fact he hit somebody?
This is going to sound crazy, but you ready for this?
Okay.
So, obviously got a good friend that works for the Hawks. He tells me that Ivan Johnson is the most responsible player of anybody the last couple of years with his per diem money. He'll take, usually their per diem money is $75 to $125 a day, and he'll just eat Subway and he'll pocket the rest. And, you know, seeing these young guys come into the league and the irresponsibility of the Shabazz Muhammads and the Michael Beasleys of the world, you know, I just think a responsible guy like that could really teach our young guys something off the court. No, I'm reaching here. I don't really. I just wanted
he is 29 years old, by the way. He's been in the, you know, looking for a job like this for a while.
Yeah, but I mean, he saves his money. He's practical. He eats Subway, eats fresh. So no, that's honestly the best I got. There's really, I mean, if there was somebody out there to be excited about, you know, we would be, but really this off season has been fantastic. And at this point, you're looking at fillers, you know, I'm just getting a little greedy here. We should be really happy with what we got.
Yeah, I'd honestly, I mean, if I was Dell right now, I'd probably just call up Lou Amundson, sign him, and call it a day.
Yeah. I mean, I would too, but the word was that Lou Amundson was kind of the consolation prize for all the other teams who missed out on Oden. Dallas is interested, San Antonio, et cetera, which to me kind of tells you exactly what we should expect from Greg Oden. If Lou Amundson is the consolation prize, that pretty much tells you what Greg Oden is. I mean, you're looking at a guy that you're hoping could be your fifth big man. So I understand the name, but bringing it all back around, I wouldn't be too frustrated that we missed out on Oden. It doesn't seem like our fans are anyway.
Yeah. So I do notice that I gotta do this. Every post we have over the past couple weeks, somebody's mentioned that we should bring back Aaron Gray. Any interest in Aaron Gray?
He's not a free agent. I don't understand how people don't know this stuff. It's really, we live in the age of the internet. It's so easy. I mean, I have my little toolbar set up top. I have, you know, all my websites. I could find out anybody with their contract and free agent status is in the drop of a dime. And yet, I still can't get this through to people on Aaron Gray. He is not a free agent. If you want him, you're going to have to trade for him or line up with all the other suitors next year, you know, when they bring him in, you know, fly him around 6-7 different cities like they will with LeBron. So
right.
Wait till next year on Aaron the Gray, not Aaron the White.
Oh, that's terrible. All right, so let's move on to something else. Uniforms.
Beautiful.
Do you like them?
So I'll say that the thing is that when you're looking back at the uniforms that are timeless and, you know, don't have to be changed and, you know, that people like and wear forever, it's always the classic ones. I mean, the ones like the Toronto Raptors or Memphis Grizzlies or the, you know, the out of the box like ones like that that people get all excited for first and foremost. In a couple of years, they're gone, and then you look back 15, 20 years later, and they look ridiculous. So the timeless I get, I don't want to get nitpicky, but honestly, when Jason Smith came out, I barely saw New Orleans on his chest, and the first glance I didn't love. I liked everything else out. I liked the new, the N and the O picture. I liked the back. I liked the logos. I loved the shorts. Honestly, the only thing I would change is if that font is a 10 on the jerseys, I'd bump it up to a 12. And to me, they'd be a solid 9. That is the only critique I really had, but I think they put a lot of time into everything with the rebrand, thinking about the name, you know, how it relates to the city and really making this team, New Orleans' team, once and for all. So I thought they put so much thought into it. Really, am I going to get that nitpicky over the font on the jerseys? I'm going to choose not to, but that would be the only thing. If I could give any advice, is to bump that up a notch. Otherwise, I like them, and I think they'll endure.
Yeah, I was just meh. So, I mean, I didn't want, like, anything. I don't want to be, like you said, like, 5 years from now, people like look back at us like they look back at the Detroit Pistons when they had the horse on the, like, kind of like a turquoise blue and pink color. I don't want that. But, come on, this is New Orleans. Have a little pizzazz on these things. I like the shorts. I like the logos at the bottom of the shorts, and that was pretty much the only thing I looked at and said, yeah, that's cool. So, I don't know. I was like, ugh. But, you know, I'm not exactly their target demographic either, because I only own 2 Hornets jerseys anyways. So.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm trying to figure out what, when we say that a jersey is good or bad, what we're measuring. Like, do we care how they look on our players on the court? And if so, why? What does that matter at all? Are we saying that we want them to look good so that they look good on us when we buy them and wear them out? Like, I guess I'm trying to figure out, before you tell me, you ask me whether a jersey is good or not, what am I qualifying it with? What is my, not just my criteria, but based on what? Who wearing it am I measuring?
Well, I think it should be a little fashion forward and, you know, fit into the Project Runway show. That's what I want. Really, you're asking me like you're trying to like do a philosophical discussion about, you know, how we should really judge these uniforms. I look at it and I think I probably wouldn't buy that. So that's what I'm thinking.
So we are not talking about we don't want them to have pizzazz because we want our players to look pizzazzful. We want them to have pizzazz so we can wear them. So yeah, based on that, I don't think I will ever fashionably wear another man's jersey. I think that time has passed. I'm over 30 years old now. I can't imagine that I will ever wear a jersey out. You know, I wear old ones sometimes when I walk my dog because I don't care about how I look. But as a fashion statement, I will never, ever wear one again in my life. So based on that, I guess I am not the target audience either.
All right. So, anyways, I mean, I'm not like upset by it. It's just like you're not gonna get like a soundbite out of me that they're terrible. It's just they're not exciting either. They're fine. So, I mean, so if I was telling you like what uniform I like the best right now in the league right now, probably I kind of enjoy the Thunder one. It's a little different. Has the blue one with the Thunder down going up down. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so you would wear that.
Oh, I doubt I'd wear it though.
Yeah. Then what are we talking about?
But you know, if I was an Oklahoma City Thunder fan, I would be more interested in buying that than something like the Pelicans app.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I guess. Like I said, I mean, to me, you could only whiff on this. To me, this really would have only mattered if they would have been the worst jerseys of all time. If they would have been Houston Astros mid 80s, just disgusting, and now everybody's laughing at your team. You know, nobody cares about the middle of the road jerseys. Nobody cares about the Pacers, the Grizzlies, whatever. I was just hoping for, you know, not being the laughing stock of the league, and that was accomplished. So home run.
All right. So let's like to actually talk about games. Instead of talking about, you know, fashion sense, because I'm not a fashion person. So the best part of this week was the schedule came out. So let's talk about actual games. We've already had a little bit of a tiff on the blog about your analysis of the schedule. So I think the first 30 games or 30 days, really, of the schedule is probably one of the easiest schedules I've ever seen. And you think March is a little easier, but I just let's talk about those first 30 games. I keep saying 30 games. 30 days is 15 games. Is this a good thing or a bad thing that the Pelicans open up with such an easy schedule? Because I only think five teams in those first 15 games have even a hope at the playoffs.
Yeah, I can't decide because on one hand, the team is probably inarguably going to be playing better the second half of the season. I mean, you know, this is a team that just hasn't played together very much, so you would imagine that it's going to take them a little while to gel. But on the other hand, I don't think anything could be better for this team than getting out to a hot start. I guess my biggest fear is with lumping all these not easy but easier games together at the beginning is if you're not playing good basketball at that point, and let's say in these first 15 games you go 8-7 or 7-8, then you know you've really just missed an opportunity to where if you have these same 15 games, you know, let's say in February, you could probably go somewhere between 10-5 and 12-3. So you basically gave away four games there just because you had the easier games early before you gelled. But, you know, if they could come out of camp playing good ball and are 100% healthy, which to me is another good part of having the easy schedule early, is you're more likely than not going to have Eric Gordon in these games, at least you hope, then I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that you're talking about a 10-5 to, you know, as crazy as it seems, like a 12-3 or 13-2 start. Like I look at these games at Memphis, you're the underdog. At San Antonio, you're the underdog. Home against Indiana and home against Golden State, it's probably borderline.
No, you're underdog.
You think you're definitely okay. Indiana at home, I agree with, but I like that game because Indiana's on the second night of a back-to-back. It's your home opener. They've already had their home opener and all that energy expanded, whatever. But okay, Indiana might be the favorite. Golden State at home, especially if they're 11-3 at that time or 11-2, whatever. I don't know, but anyway, I think you're definitely underdog at Memphis and at San Antonio. But again, those are two teams that they played well the last couple years, even when they were bad. They split against Memphis last year. I guess what I'm saying is I always try to think of it. You look at the schedule as 82 games and you say, oh, that's a win, that's a loss, whatever, this far out. But I try to put myself in the moment and I'm writing the game preview for that game. Do I really feel like we have no chance of winning X game? I look at the schedule and maybe at San Antonio, but the other 15, I'll go into that night pretty optimistic that the Pelicans could win that game if they're playing, if they're healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's a good thing that they have this first month to like actually figure things out and not if they make a mistake or do something wrong, they're not going to be buried necessarily. They'll probably lose a couple games because of it, but it's not like, you know, they're going to be crushed and they're going to be demoralized. They can always just bounce back against another crappy team the next night. But I am a little worried that when, you know, if they go out to like a lead of like 11, they have 11-2 record or something like that, and then suddenly they start hitting in December some of these nasty series of games, I don't know. Is that going to break a young team? I mean, there's a stretch in December where it's OKC, Detroit, Memphis, Denver, Golden State, the Clippers. I mean, there's a couple places where they could run into some trouble.
Yeah, I mean, but I would think that, you know, you get that confidence up, you get a bit of a cushion. That's when you start to win games. that you otherwise wouldn't win when, you know, you're really starting to believe in what's working. I mean, I think the biggest thing for this team is I think Gordon, Drew Holiday, and Tyreke Evans will have zero problem sharing the ball if they're winning. I think that if the team starts losing, each of those guys, not because they're selfish, but because they believe enough in their own skills, might think that they have to start pressing more and doing more in order to help the team win. I think if you could get out winning early and Monty could say, look, you know, we had success with this style of basketball. Yeah, we're losing now, but we'll get through this again. I think getting out to a hot start could always give Monty something to go back on to tell the guys, look, it was working. We just got to stick with it and do what we were doing then. So I like it. I think it could energize the fan base. I think it could do a lot of positive things versus if you flip December and November's schedule, and now all of a sudden, you know, the Saints are doing well, they're 7-2, and the Pelicans, you know, in December are 5-14, you know, nobody's looking their way. So I think it could be a positive thing if they get out to a hot start. And looking at that schedule, getting the Lakers twice by November 12th could mean two games where you don't have to play against Kobe. Like, there's the possibility that they could catch a lot of breaks here.
Yeah, so then the question I have for you is, you know, we're talking about the easy stretches. You think March is pretty easy because there's a whole lot of homestand games. I mean,
right.
Well, there's like five games that they're away that entire month, which is pretty nice. But what stretch of this schedule do you pretty much look at and say, yeah, there's a series of losses?
I mean, honestly, it could be that last month. That last month is brutal.
This last four games, how does that happen? At OKC, at Houston, versus OKC, versus Houston.
Yeah, I mean, you only play OKC three times, which I think was a minor break that the Pelicans got. I mean, you play OKC three times and Phoenix four times. If those are switched, that, you know, that's probably a one-game difference. And that's what I was, you know, about the schedule, why I thought it was important, is there's a lot of one-game difference type things in there. And the fact that you only have to play OKC three times, or what I really liked is you only have to play Golden State three times, and two of them are at home. So you only have to go to Golden State, one of the harder places to win, one. So I thought there was a lot of interesting breaks there in the schedule. But, yeah, April, coming down that stretch, to me, you have one cupcake game. You have Phoenix at home on the 9th. Other than that, you're at Denver, you're at Utah, which, even though it'll be a bad team, that's still a really tough place to win. You're at Portland, a tough place to win, at OKC, at Houston, and then you have OKC and Houston at home. I mean, that's a month where, you know, I'm hoping the Pelicans have a decent cushion on a playoff spot, or OKC and Houston somehow have wrapped up, you know, certain things they need to wrap up, even though I don't see how that's possible. But it's going to be tough. There's eight games. If they go 3-5 in those eight games, that's a small victory.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was the part that I looked at and was, like, the most cringeworthy I felt. There's a couple unpleasant road trips, but, I mean, I don't know. As a whole, every year I always seemed like I would do an analysis, a month-by-month analysis of it, and I always felt like, you know, even the months I was calling easy, there was always, like, a stretch of three or four games in there that I was like, yeah, that's not easy, though. But there's, you know, you're right. March is a pretty cake month, and you add November. I mean, how did this happen? I mean, couldn't be any happier to see it, like, end up this way.
And before we even get to March, I would just ask people to look at the month after All-Star Weekend, because remember, it's going to be in New Orleans this year. It's going to create a lot of excitement. you know, you're going to have, hopefully you have Pelicans that get in, but if they don't, they'll have a chip on their shoulder because, you know, they weren't in the game in their hometown. They'll have also have seen, you know, the biggest stars in their hometown, and the city will get that extra buzz. Coming right off of All-Star weekend, I think you have a stretch there for that month. I mean, you got New York at home the first game back. Then you have punching bags in Charlotte and Washington. You have the Clippers at home, you know, and a little road trip, but really four out of the five teams in that road trip should be non-playoff contenders. And then you get into that long homestand that we've talked about. I mean, I could really see a hot start followed by, you know, a stretch where they run into some difficult competition and find their way, and then they get that All-Star break to kind of recuperate and, you know, also to get the city buzzing. And then coming out of that All-Star break, I really think the next month lines up well for them to just go on a nice little run again to get them back in the playoff picture and hopefully solidified before they go into that brutal April. So it's really going to be a season that looks like it's going to be a bit of a roller coaster, at least for the level of competition that they're going to be facing. But man, I mean, it's just, isn't it so exciting to know how close we are? 2 months away from preseason, less than 3 months away from the start of the regular season. Like, we're actually going to be watching New Orleans games that matter again.
Yeah. And we'll be actually able to watch a series of athletic players, which is, I mean, that's the thing that I've just, it's been such a long time since even like the Chris Paul teams. I mean, you had Paul, who was a phenomenal athlete. You had Tyson Chandler. There wasn't any other athletes on those teams. This team has stocked with athletes. So maybe I'm being stupid because I remember one time Atlanta was doing the same sort of thing where they just brought in a bunch of 6'7 to 6'9 guys who were all athletic, and they're like, yeah, we're going to win. They fell apart and were terrible. But, you know, I have a feeling that won't end up that way with this particular team.
Yeah, they didn't have a guy that could tie it all together by being one of the top 5 to 10 players in the league like the Pelicans do with Davis. And again, it always comes back to that. It seems like the national guys who believe in what the Pelicans are doing seem to remember that Anthony Davis could be a once in a generation type player. And the guys who don't believe in what they did this off season, you know, just seem to forget that and focus more on the three guards when really, as you said, you know, in that piece, those are the complementary pieces, and this team is going to be as good as Davis is going to be. And watching him, like I said, watching him in summer league become a leader, and then just watching the face up jumper in the Team USA game, I'm just so excited about what he's going to be, and that's going to mean everything to this team.
So I did want to jump on you about one thing and see what your take is on this. Because on the face of it, it sounds bad, and it should be surprising. But so Bill Simmons, I always like to see what he says. Whether I agree with him or not is hit or miss. But he basically came out in one of his last articles and said he hated both moves that the Pelicans pulled off. And one of his things was that he thought that essentially the Pelicans traded, obtained Jrue Holiday, and if they hadn't made that trade, they could have had for this next year Nerlens Noel, their draft pick for the next year, and Brandon Jennings for the money they're paying Holiday. So do you think that criticism is fair, that it was a terrible trade because of that kind of trade-off?
I think it's fair in the sense that it could have happened. I mean, it's fair in the sense that the reality that he created is possible. Mm-hmm. Is it fair in the sense that the alternate reality he created would be better than the one that actually happened? I think I think my record stands. I think we've had 100 and something podcasts now. I have definitely pointed out when this team has made mistakes, when I didn't believe in its direction, when it did something wrong. I don't think I'm a homer. To me, those two are not even close. And, I mean, anybody who follows Bill Simmons, you know that, I mean, he's the guy that if Wayne Brady is offering him $1,500 cash or what's behind curtain number two, he's always going to take curtain number two. He's just, and this goes for a lot of, I mean, this goes for a lot of fans, quite honestly. It's why fans fall in love with the draft, because of the potential of the unknown. But to me, I've been trying to rack my brain about why analysts, you know, some of them don't love this as much as I think it clearly should be loved. And quite honestly, it's because I don't think we have ever seen it before. And the cliche holds true. People are afraid of the unknown. And it's true. We have never seen a 19, 20-year-old franchise, once-in-a-generation type guy and then seen a team build this way in his second year. Usually that guy has either been surrounded by veteran talent, like you saw with Duncan in San Antonio, or we see a slow kind of build the way that, you know, Kevin Garnett and the Minnesota Timberwolves did it, or Kevin Durant and OKC did it. We've seen two formulas. We have never, ever in the history of the NBA seen this formula, and that just scares people because they have absolutely no precedent to point back to and say whether this works or not. So, of course, if it's the first time and you have a franchise that, you know, even though it wasn't Dell Demps, you know, in the past has had some blunders and, you know, made some head-scratching moves, I think your gut reaction is going to be against it, but, you know, time will tell in a couple of years.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I wanted to respond when I read that, so, you know, if I had the hotline to Bill, I would actually use his own arguments against him, which has always been, you don't trade a dollar for four quarters in the NBA. It doesn't work. Whenever you trade for smaller talented players, so the idea is, like, if you have an all-star who's worth a dollar, having that dollar is better than having four C-level players who are equivalent to quarters, because, you know, basically you're mastering one position and getting way more out of it than having a bunch of average guys at four different spots. And he gives a whole bunch of examples. He did it in his book, but essentially, it's all about your valuation of Drew Holiday, really, is how I think this breaks down. And there, Drew Holiday is all across the board. I mean, Doolittle, who has his stuff on ESPN, he doesn't have Drew Holiday as a top 15 point guard in the league for this upcoming season. With Warp.
Yeah,
project. And if you look at Holiday, what he did over the course of last season was not good. It wasn't as bad. I mean, because it includes those 2 months where he was terrible, but his whole team was terrible, and there's a lot of reasons for that. We're projecting the idea that he'll be like what he was for the first, you know, 3 months or 4 months of the season, and that he'll be pretty good. But if you even look over the course of, like, his entire career, he's never had an amazing season where you're like, wow. But then, of course, those are all based on advanced stats, which do a notoriously awful job on the defensive end of the ball. And honestly, that's the upgrade that I think Drew Holiday brings that really helps. And in my world, like, even if I'm being uncharitable, maybe I don't think Drew Holiday's is a buck. Maybe he's a 75-cent piece. But if we're talking about those three players, the other three items, like Nerlens Noel, I have no idea what kind of NBA player that guy's going to be. If you look at every single bit of analysis of the guy, I mean, he is unbelievably unique in his physical build, his stature, what he did in college, what talents he brought. No one can figure out what he is. And he's injured. You don't know if he's going to come back even what he was. So, I mean, maybe he's a 50-cent piece. I don't know what you consider the 14th pick in any draft, but to me, it's like a dime. I mean, I don't care how deep the draft is, the 14th pick, you're probably not getting anything really out of that. And so then it all comes down to what you consider Brandon Jennings. So, you know, what, is he a quarter? Is he 50 cents? The guy's one of the worst shooters in the league. You and I were dreading the idea he might make like 9 or 10 million from our team. And, I mean, I don't think that he's particularly great as a basketball player. So if you're coming back to me and saying, you know, Drew Holiday, oh, I think he sucks. He's only a 75-cent piece. He's not really a dollar. But the best I could still come up to is maybe 75 cents for the other guys total. And that's three different guys.
Yeah.
I'm still fine with that.
I
think Drew Holiday is probably going to be a dollar.
I agree. It seems like after every one of those analysis bashed our trade, they then turned around and said, oh, but this isn't about Drew Holiday. He's a fine player. No, it is about Drew Holiday, because if you trade those two picks for LeBron James, everybody's behind it. So you are talking about the player that they traded for and, you know, whether or not they've got, you know, they got value in return and what you think of Holiday. And it's true. I'm going more based on the first four or five seasons in which, you know, if that guy would have sustained throughout the entire year.
His first months, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would have been a trade that everybody applauded. And honestly, I think it's one that Philly wouldn't have made, or they would have asked for more in return. The other thing that I think is really funny in this is apparently Philly would have taken Oladipo, Bennett, or Noel. I really am so curious about how people would have judged the trade if it would have been Bennett at six. Because then all of us, I really believe that they would have given the Pelicans a standing ovation because they didn't like Bennett, yet we don't know what Noel is going to be either. I mean, to me, you have no clue which one of the, you know, what those guys are going to be. So I think that's a big part of it that shouldn't be, because whether it's Bennett or whether it's Noel, you have no idea what that guy is going to be. But yeah, it all comes down to Holiday, because there are players in the NBA that are worth those two picks. These analysts just don't think Holiday is, because, you know, basically there's a lot of good but not great point guards out there on the market that you could get. I disagree. I think he's great. I think he's great on the defensive end. This isn't hindsight. I would ask anybody to go back to the late January podcast where, you know, I said Holiday was better right now than Rondo before he got hurt. You know, I truly believe that both sides of the ball factored in. You know, he's a top five point guard in the NBA moving forward, especially as he gets to work with Monty. And I mean, think of Mike Conley at the age of 22. Like, you know, people act like these players are set in stone and they're not going to continue to improve. I mean, Drew Holiday is 40-50% better than Mike Conley at that same age. And, you know, now with stability, I only see him getting better. To me, I would do the trade 100 out of 100 times. And let's not forget, not only did Detroit have to give Brandon Jennings $8 million a year, but they also had to give up a first-round pick.
All right.
I mean, are we sure that Nerlens Noel is definitely going to be better than Brandon Knight? I mean, we don't know. They're both top 10 picks. So, I mean, not only did Detroit have to give them $8 million, but they had to give up a young prospect, which honestly we wouldn't have had. Jeff Teague was matched. So where else are you getting your point guard from? To me, it's still a trade. I'm not defending just because I'm a fan, but to me it was a no-brainer.
Right. Now, I mean, it's possible that Nerlens Noel turns into something amazing, in which case this trade was bad. I won't argue that fact. Or even, like, somehow that 13th or 14th pick in next year's draft gets, you know, hits a gold mine. Then, yeah, you could say that. But as a general, like, risk analysis and figuring out, like, what the downside is, I mean, there's no way you can ever come up with the idea that both those things are going to hit and be way better than an all-star point guard.
See,
and you know, people like to ram this idea of like he's not really an all-star. No, he's an all-star point guard, and he played like an all-star point guard up until the all-star game. So,
see, I don't agree that it comes down to Nerlens Noel or even whoever gets taken with the pick. Like, people still laugh at the fact that the Charlotte Hornets traded Kobe Bryant for Vlade Divac. To me, the Hornets shouldn't be the one laughed at. It should be the if Kobe Bryant's going to be that great, the 12 teams that passed on him, they should be the ones laughed at. The Hornets made a terrific trade of trading the 13th pick for, at the time, I would say a top 8 to 10 center in the starting center in the NBA.
Yeah.
So that's not the Hornets that are making the bonehead choice there. They are merely trading a pick that, you know, has shown over time is a C-minus asset for a starting center in the NBA. I think it holds true here. I don't care who the pick was. Dell Demps was trading the 6th pick. He wasn't trading Nerlens Noel. He wasn't trading Anthony Bennett. He wasn't trading Trey Burke. That was Philadelphia's choice who they wanted. He was trading the 6th pick in a bad draft and a pick that he has no clue what number it'll be next year, but he protected himself in case it is one of the top 5. I don't think it matters who those picks turn into. If Nerlens Noel keeps having injuries and never plays again, to me, the trade isn't any better or worse. It's what value assets did you have at the time, and did you get more in return for them? And I think they did. So.
Okay. So I understand you have some fan questions. So do you want to get to those next?
Yeah. Couple of interesting ones. Ian Walker, I hope it's not Ian, but Ian Walker on Twitter asks, so how long do you expect us to gel, and, you know, specifically offensively versus defensively? Which of those do you think takes longer, and how long do you expect it to take this team to gel?
I'll be honest, I don't expect the team to be firing efficiently until probably end of December. And I always feel that it takes longer to put in an offense than a defense. I think a defense, it's harder for you to keep people focused on every part of the defense, but it's easy to get the ideas of a defense, like the philosophy of what you're trying to do in there. Offensively, what they usually end up doing is they layer in, you know, a set of plays. Once those are down, then they layer in another set of plays, and it keeps getting more and more elaborate as time goes on. Defensively, I don't feel that normally they do that, and they basically say, this is what we're going to do in all these, you know, different situations, and basically we'll stick to that. And then as they find players are weak at some things and strong at others, then they try to help them out in those situations. I would probably say, which is why it's kind of nice, honestly, to have that first month is, you know, the team's not going to be together yet. So that first month of easy games helps them get around that liability. So, I mean, that's what I think. What do you think?
You have
more coaching experience than I do.
I actually think the defense is going to take a little longer to gel because on offense, first of all, there's so much talent on the offensive end. That on offense, if a play breaks down, you know, Jerry V talks about this all the time, you have guys now who could get their own and who could make something happen. So I think that there's more room for improv on that end, more room for almost succeeding by mistake.
But you think that's like a – I don't think that's like the plan, though.
Well, it wasn't what – you know, where will we be better planned for success? It's where are we going to achieve more success? And I just think that on offense, there's more room for error when you have this much talent. On defense, yeah, they'll have certain philosophies down, but I think the first month or two, Monty is really going to be playing around with different rotations and trying to figure out, you know, stuff on that end and, you know, exactly who could cover which positions. And I don't know. I just think the precision on the defensive end, you're reacting to somebody else. And whenever you're reacting to somebody else, I think that takes longer than when you are, you know, causing the action to happen. So I just think that we'll see, I think we'll see more efficiency. I think the team will gel better. Now, where you might see problems, and I don't want to compare this team to the Miami Heat, but in some ways they've put together guys, you know, who like to have the ball in their hand like the Heat have. And remember those first year, especially with the Heat, the first 2 years actually, their offense was really good. The problem came in the final 2-3 minutes. And I think that's where you could see problems as this team tries to figure out who they are in the final couple minutes of games. But I think the first 45, 46 minutes of games, I trust the offense to come together a little quicker than the defense.
So there you have it, Ian. We disagree entirely. So you should pick me because I'm better than Michael.
Pick him. This one's from Tom Didler. What one offensive or defensive stat would you like to see improved? Let's talk about some of the top guys or two or three of the top guys on the roster, but where would you like to see offensively and defensively certain guys improve just stat-wise?
Well, I mean, if we're talking just defensive stat, honestly, steals, which most people would be probably surprised by, because steals, there's always like this negative connotation to a steal. It seems like every writer always has to say, well, he steals a ball, but he gambles too much. And it's like steals are bad. But honestly, steals and blocks are actually a very good indicator of how athletic and quick your team is and your ability to cause chaos. And while, yes, there will be risk involved if your team likes to steal, if our team can put together some nice steal numbers, that almost inevitably leads to the team getting out and running. And that is what I want to see this team doing. This team is built to be a thoroughbred running team. So I want to see those steals numbers go up. I want to see Eric Gordon get back to what he used to be, steals numbers. He used to be a very good thief. Tyreke Evans has always been a good thief. Jrue Holiday is a pretty solid thief on his own right. Anthony Davis is already one of the best big man thieves around. Ryan Anderson's playing basketball out there somewhere. Might get a steal or two. But those other four guys can really, really light it up out there on steals, and that's what I want to see the most. What about you?
Do you think even Aminu could get a little bit more aggressive on that end since he has more talent around him?
So Aminu, I've always felt, doesn't get the credit he deserves for his ability to disrupt, because he always seems to be the guy with his long, freaky arms doing like the Plastic Man, knock the ball away, and then the ball goes to somebody else and they get the credit for the steal. So I think Aminu is actually, you're right. I mean, Aminu is somebody I should have included in there, is somebody who could really wreak havoc.
Yeah, for me, the one that I look at is, and this is what's funny to me, is that, you know, some of the national writers who haven't liked the Pelicans offseason, they point to two things that they don't really like about the team, and I think those two things could actually, they'll both help each other. So this all comes down to Jrue Holiday. So the national writers say, well, you have all these guys with these high usage rates. How are you going to get them all the ball? And then they also talk about how individually inefficient a lot of, you know, these young guards were last year. So I look at Jrue Holiday. And last year, I mean, his turnovers were way up. You're talking about a guy that, I mean, his turnover percentage rose over 4%. Just raw stats, he was up about a turnover and a half per game last year. But then you look, and his usage was also up 5%. So just as we were told by the Philadelphia guys, his, you know, he had to do so much more. He was the only guy on that team, especially by the end of the year. His usage went way up and his turnovers went way up as well. I think if he gets his usage down, which he should this year with all the talent he has around him, we're going to see the turnovers, not just the raw turnovers, but the turnover percentage dip considerably back to where he was the previous season, where honestly, you know, he was better than average for a starting point guard when it came to turning the ball over. So for me, that's the biggest one is I wish I could see the end of the year stats. If I could look at anything, I would love to look at Drew Holiday and his turnovers per game or turnover percentage, either one of those. And I think I would have a good indication for how the season turned out if I could look at those numbers. But based on the past, I fully expect his turnover percentage to go down because I think his usage will go down.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really funny about us like trying to like pick out stats is, I mean, essentially we have three guards who are basically the best guard on three awful teams. And I've never seen in the NBA a team go out and acquire three really young guards who were all the best, you know, ball handler and scorer on their team and throw them together onto one team and see what happens. It doesn't ever happen. So it's going to be a fun ride this year.
And not only that, but again, I don't want to get too excited about Summer League, but if we see improvement from Austin Rivers, maybe not even this year, maybe it doesn't really happen until next year, but now you're talking about four guards who, you know, really are good with the ball in their hands and create on their own. And again, it's just, I will never say we have too many of those guys because we've never had two of these guys on the same. I mean, maybe Speedy Claxton and Chris Paul in his rookie year, but other than that, I mean,
really?
That's what I'm saying. I'm reaching for Speedy Claxton. So I will never say we have too many of these guys. We have to trade one. If they're all healthy and playing well, it's a fantastic problem to have.
Okay, so who's next for the question?
I guess this one is simple, and I think we could probably wait till, you know, preseason to really get into projections. But Patrick Worth's question's real easy. Take it for whatever you want it to mean. What's our floor and what's our ceiling for this year?
All right, so I actually feel our ceiling, and this is contingent on Eric Gordon's health and Anthony Davis's progression, and the defensive gel. I could see that if everything went right, the defensive team gels, everybody's doing what they're supposed to, Gordon stays healthy for at least most of the year, and Anthony Davis does what we expect him to do, but even a little more, we could hit 50 wins, and I wouldn't be stunned. I think also our floor, though, is Eric Gordon spends most of the season on the bench. Drew plays exactly the way he did the last couple of months of the last season. Anthony Davis doesn't really take any step forward at all. I mean, the team could possibly only win 31 or 32 games.
Yeah, I got our floor a little higher than that just because, I mean, I guess maybe if we're really talking worst case scenario, Anthony Davis would get hurt too, but I think he's on that Kevin Garnett path like you talked about where he's worth a handful of wins on his own. So I think at minimum, this is a 34 win team, but I agree with what you say about 50. And honestly, the team that I think has kind of set the precedent here in some ways, and that I'm somewhat reminded of is the Golden State Warriors. So the Warriors in the strike shortened season, I mean, I know it was a shorter season, but they only won 23 games. Then last year, they come out and they win 47. And, you know, you see some similarities. First of all, you see a young team, but you see a team whose, you know, best player just kept getting injured and injured and injured. And then finally, you know, he puts together a season where he's healthy, that he shows the talent that he had all along. I mean, if you're talking about getting anything close to that, from Eric Gordon this year combined with all of the other things that you have on this team. Yeah, I could see that. I think, I mean, just getting specific about the schedule, I think going 21-9 against the East isn't out of the question. And then, you know, then it really comes down to the Western Conference and, you know, can you win 29 out of the 52 games against the Western Conference? Yeah, I think it's possible. So I could see 50 as an absolute ceiling, but again, things would have to go right the way that they did for the Warriors last year, where you had your role players stepping up. I mean, Greg Steensma would have to give you what Festus Ezeli gave you, and Aminu would have to give you all the intangibles Draymond Green did, and, you know, Austin Rivers would essentially, you know, he's pretty much our rookie this year if you're looking at it. He would have to give you some stretches the way that Harrison Barnes did during the season, but I think it's possible. I think some teams in the Western Conference really come back down to earth this year, and I don't see any rising outside of maybe the Rockets. I don't think there's any team in the Western Conference that's 8-10 games better than they were last year, and I think that there's 3 or 4 who could be 8 or 10 games worse than they were last year.
Yeah. Yeah, the only other team, I think, if everything goes right, that could have a big leap in the Western Conference, other than Houston, I expect Houston to get a leap, would possibly be Portland. I wouldn't be shocked. If that team like completely gels and C.J. McCollum is the player we kind of expected him to be, they could have a little bit of a leap, but...
Yeah, I think I think in this effort to make their bench better, I mean, they shot themselves. They get Mo Williams now to take away minutes from McCollum, and you have that LaMarcus Aldridge drama, which is already starting. Which, you know.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'm not. I'm a little down on them for next year, but if it's possible, that's the one team I look at. Like, you know, Damian Lillard could still improve a little bit.
Yes. So I think Minnesota is the one team that can make the leap just because of being healthy. I mean, you're talking about a 10-game leap. Can they win 41 games? Yeah.
Yeah, they could do that. You're right. I forgot about Minnesota. All right, let's move on. Okay. Got one more for me?
Well, actually, I got I think that's – I mean, it kind of ties in, but really I just I had a couple of questions and – it's kind of bittersweet. This is going to be probably one of our last podcasts in quite a while. So just wanted to say that I appreciated everybody, you know, listening. And this has been a great year, and I can't wait till next year. So just a couple more. I guess my question to you, what is the biggest – everything's in play here, not just players, but everything. What is your biggest unknown still about this team? When you try to do all your projections and figure out how this is going to play out of every single possible factor, what is the biggest unknown for you about this team and hardest for you to try to figure out when you project?
Honestly, it is the small forward position, really, still. I know the idea is, you know, maybe Aminu will take that, or Morrow might steal it from him, or Tyreke Evans might steal it from him. I have no idea what we're going to get out of our small forward spot. And it doesn't matter, like, tremendously when you come to projections, because you really just project how much every player is going to play minutes-wise and then give yourself some sort of, you know, a value for what they produce. But I cannot figure out how they're going to make that small forward position work with the rest of the team around it because of the limitations of the players that they could put there. Like, I don't think Evans is a great fit in that role. If you put him there, then you have a you're not as good of a rebounding team as you need to. And then you're playing him with two guys who also need the ball. And you put Aminu there, and, you know, we've talked ad nauseum about his limitations and his benefits. It's just like there isn't any perfect fit for that spot. And I really want to see how that second wing position, Monty fills it and how it works as the season goes forward.
So my biggest unknown, it's weird. You brushed on him in the last part of your last sentence. I feel like I pretty much know who these players are, and I have a realistic expectation I feel like it's, you know, I'm going to be within 3 to 5% at most as far as, you know, projecting them, whether you're talking about their stats or their impact, whatever. I have no idea what kind of coach Monty Williams is. And that sounds crazy because it's been 3 years, but year one, completely wet behind the ears. Chris Paul was basically running that offense. Mike Malone running the defense. We saw him get out-coached quite a bit at times, especially by Popovich, but we also saw some promise. Then the next 2 years, he had little to no talent. He, you know, in the first year, he got guys who were motivated to get new contracts to play a little above their heads. Second year, you know, completely young roster, and honestly, winning wasn't the top priority. It was developing or whatever. Now, winning is the only thing. It's the top priority, and he has all this talent. He has talent that says you need to go up tempo. I have zero idea what to project for Monty Williams. To me, he is easily and by far the biggest question mark surrounding this entire team, and how he does, you know, in a multitude of different areas, and how he manages this team is going to have as huge of an impact as, to me, any player.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of that's where I was going in a really roundabout way was, right, I don't know what he's going to do with some of this stuff. It's the first time he's got a plethora of riches. So it'll be good to see. Hopefully he'll surprise all of us.
Yeah, that's going to be the part that I think is such a huge factor I can't project. But my other question, so we talked about the schedule. If both teams are completely healthy, how many teams in the Western Conference would you say are clearly favored over the Pelicans at a game in New Orleans? So a home game. How many teams coming in are clearly the favorite?
So the big four at the top, which are OKC, San Antonio, Clippers, and Memphis. I don't think there's any question that those guys will continue to be favored. Houston, because Dwight Howard's there, they're going to be favored. Golden State, I have a feeling, when you talk about favor, you're also talking about, you know, convincing people to bet, and people are going to bet Golden State over, you know, the Pelicans anyways, just because of what they did last season in the playoffs. So I think Golden State would be favored. And that's it. I think Denver, they're the only other team who was a top echelon team last year, but they've got they've lost Iguodala. Gallinari is not going to be back right away. They're one of those teams that has no superstar that is known across the country. So even though they probably will have a better record than some people are predicting, because I've seen some predictions in the low 30s, I think that's a little silly. I still don't think that they would be favored in New Orleans over the Pelicans. Do you have anybody else?
I guess we're talking about Vegas. To me, I thought about – so I remember the 2007-08 season so clearly. That's still, I think, a season that is, you know, dearest in most fans' hearts. And I remember, like, playing San Antonio at home or even Dallas back then. And when we won those games, I was like, wow, that's a victory to be proud of. I didn't expect that. You know, we were clearly the underdog in that game, and it felt so good to start beating those teams after they had beat us so often in years past. This year, I only feel that way with three teams. There's only three teams that if they came into New Orleans, if I was honest with myself, I would be expecting a loss and would be, you know, thrilled with a win, and that's the Clippers, San Antonio, and Oklahoma City. I mean, you put Memphis up there, and I know they had a great run last year, but again, that's a team we went 2-2 against. And honestly, the only matchup that scared me at all last year with Memphis was when Mike Conley and Gravis Vasquez were on the floor, Conley just destroyed him. You could look at all their on-off statistics, and that was by far the biggest mismatch in that series. I'm not afraid of even going to Memphis. I wouldn't be that thrilled with a victory at Memphis. I really don't think they're a better team than the Pelicans are. I think it's close enough. So, to me, those are the three teams. Houston, I think they added, you know, if your analogy holds true, they added a dollar piece and they lost a couple of quarters along the way. But I think that there was a chemistry and an underdog mentality. And also, nobody had them on the circled on the schedule last year, and they played a style of basketball that was kind of gimmicky and hard to play in the regular season. I think they'll be a little bit more conventional now. To me, it's really, if those three teams come in, I'll be expecting a loss and thrilled with a victory. Honestly, the other 11, I'll fully be expecting the Pelicans to win.
Wow. Okay. I need to see a little bit more on the court before I'm willing to say that.
Yeah. Okay. So the player, I think we all know who the big five is. They might not be the starting five, but they're the five best players. But to you, the player outside of the big five who has the biggest chance to be a major X factor when we look back on this season?
So when I first saw this question when you forwarded it to me, my first thought was Jason Smith. But Jason Smith, I have a feeling, won't play. I mean, that's the idea that if he plays like a lot of minutes at center, then he could be an X factor. But I have a feeling he's not going to actually end up doing that. And I'm switching it to Austin Rivers because nobody expects anything from Austin Rivers. But what we saw in the summer league was it's possible he could actually be, although I'm not going to go as far as an efficient scoring guard off the bench, he could be a volume scoring guard off the bench, and that could be helpful in a major way. And
poor man's Jamal Crawford?
Yeah, like, you know, a better Gennaro Pargo.
Okay.
I mean, a guy who... You know, Gennaro Pargo was an awful player. That's like one of the funny things I always say. People like have like this fondness for Gennaro Pargo. The guy shot like 38%, except he had like four games where he could not miss. He was on fire. He was driving to the basket, getting out in transition, and just really controlled those games. And that's what people like. It was shocking and amazing that he could do that. I think Austin Rivers could throw a few games like that out this year.
Yeah.
So I think Austin Rivers would be mine. It's the same for you?
No, and I will say Willie Green had a couple of those games, but nobody misses him.
That's true.
Wasn't he like 12 for 12 against Phoenix? That game was insane. For me, I wasn't that excited when we signed him, but now as I see how the roster's fallen into place, to me, again, Jason Smith, I agree with. I think he's going to give you what you expect him to give you. You know, Steemsma's going to be six fouls and some tough defense on some nights, whatever. I really think that if certain things play out, Anthony Morrow could be a huge X factor. I mean, I'm looking at him as a rich man's Roger Mason. Kind of what he did last year, you know, the way he was able to spot up. And if you remember those games where Roger Mason and Ryan Anderson were both hot, the Pelicans were unbeatable. I remember a game at the Clippers that it was, you know, was just absolutely insane, hitting everything. And the idea of having Morrow in there to space either with Rhino. So you have a lot of spacing on the court, or just rotate those guys so you always have one in. But, you know, I'm thinking about the small forward position, and yeah, you have – I think Tyreek is going to get the majority of the minutes there. I think we expect a lot from Aminu, but if he falters, which I think is possible, if he goes back into Monty's doghouse, or if the team plays him more as a backup power forward – and all of a sudden, Anthony Morrow is getting those bench minutes as the backup three or playing next to Austin. as the backup two, as Tyreek starts at the three, whatever. I really think that there's a chance if he could be 80% of the guy that we saw in Golden State, the three-point ball, not just what it actually does, but the effect that it has on the defense, even when you're not shooting it, I just think that he has a chance to be a major X factor that we're really not expecting much from, but could be a guy that could completely change how other teams play us defensively.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he definitely has that ability to stretch the floor, which can be pretty scary.
Yeah.
So. And then, I like my Austin Rivers pick better, though.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that Morrow had trouble playing last year was because the Hawks and the Mavs just couldn't hide him on defense. I think you have to hide him defensively, but with all the guards, and if Austin continues to play well on the defensive end, you have four guards who are, I would say, are above average defenders. You could hide Morrow on the defensive end. So is his shot. My last question, I mean, I guess comes down to the big five. You look at the big five, we think we know who they are as players. You could look at their best case scenario, worst case scenario, but we know their skill sets and who they are. But of those guys, of the big five, pick one guy, and which component of that guy's game is the least predictable and makes it the hardest for you to project?
So I'm going to take the easy answer for the guy, Eric Gordon, but it's not because of his injury history. If you take a look at like the synergy stats for Eric Gordon, he grades out as a rock awful defender last year. And a lot of that's because of the way he played. He was lackadaisical. He did not try as hard as he should have. We saw moments where he was a pretty amazing defender. And if you look at his history, he was a better defender than what he gave us last year. But I have no idea what kind of Eric Gordon I'm going to get defensively. If he can show us like his high level of energy throughout the whole course of the season, Tyreek Evans is already a pretty solid defender. I was pretty shocked when I saw some of his numbers. Jrue Holiday is a very good defender. If Gordon can come out and give us a really high level of defensive energy, I wouldn't be shocked if the Pelicans ended up going from the 28th ranked defense to something around 10. And that's what I'm most interested to see is he going to give me any sort of defensive energy or not?
Yeah.
How about you?
I'm the same guy, and again, I'll stay away from injuries as well because we think we all know that, but mine's on the other side of the ball with Eric Gordon. I mean, injuries aside, last year he had a poor year. I mean, we're talking about a guy. His last year with the Clippers put up a PER of close to 19. Last year he was at 15, league average. We're looking at, you know, his true shooting percentage, his field goal percentage took huge dips. And looking at all the different areas where there was really a problem, the area that dipped the most is his spot-up shooting, which I think he's going to get a ton more spot-up opportunities this year than he did last year, even the year before with the talent around him. Now, 3 years ago with the Clippers, he was actually eighth in the entire NBA. He shot 45% from three when it came to spot-up shooting. He was just fantastic catch-and-shoot guy, had a lot of opportunities. Dipped to about 41% the following year, and now this last year with New Orleans, he was down to 31%. So you're talking about, you know, I mean, he dipped by 33%. I mean, it was a huge drop from when he was at his peak. And to me, if he could just knock down those spot-up jumpers, at a decent clip, at that 40 to 45% clip we saw with L.A., not to play on words, no pun intended, but if he could hit his spot up jumpers at that rate compared to the awful rate that he had last year, that's just going to do so much for his, I mean, for the team's offense overall, for his efficiency, for how people are going to have to defend him. I mean, if he's hitting that shot, they're going to have to run out harder on rotations, which is going to help him get to the basket. If I knew that he was going to be the Eric Gordon from 2-3 years ago when he came up to spot up jumpers, I'd feel confident in saying that this team was going to be a top 5-8 offense. But if he's going to be as poor pretty much in all areas offensively as he was last year, then, you know, I still think we're going to struggle in some areas.
Yeah. Yeah, I was so basically Eric Gordon is our X factor, which I don't know how to feel about that. I mean, I'm really happy that we have Tyreek Evans. So if Eric Gordon is not working out, we've got a very nice replacement just sitting in the wings waiting.
Yeah, I feel pretty comfortable in saying if you get little to nothing from Eric Gordon, if you get what you got from him the last year or two, this team has probably no shot at the playoffs. If you get the Eric Gordon that we saw his last year with the Clippers, you know, over 75 games, I would give us an 80% chance of the play. I really think it's that much of it hinges on Eric Gordon, because the worst version of him, the one in the suit on the bench versus the best version of him is, you know, there's just such a huge impact difference. So.
Yep. And he has seemed happier since they brought in some talent around him.
Well,
so I hope it works out. I really do.
Yeah. Yep. I hope we never have to have one of those podcasts again.
All right. So, got anything else you want to say? We're probably not going to come back until, you know, sometime in September with our next podcast. So anything you want to leave the listeners with?
No, that's it. Hopefully we'll have a new intro, starting next year. It's going to be a whole fresh new start for all of us. But I just want to thank you guys so much. I mean, the support of this show has just gone up so much, and you know, the way that we just have feedback now and interaction with all the listeners, it's just been great. And I know Ryan and I enjoy doing this. We appreciate any kind words, and you know, the fact that you guys keep listening is more than enough for us, and you know, we really appreciate it, and we hope that we've been entertaining and informative as well.
Yep. And so we'll be back in probably a month and a half. Thanks for listening to In the Know. You all in the city, the party town, ain't nothing but a party.